From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, how the legacy of abuse by Larry Nassar is changing our conversation on athletes' health at this year's Olympics.
There's still so much that we don't know, and there's still, for the survivors, so much that has not been resolved about what they've been through.
Then, a Michigan man turns his paddleboard-making hobby into a full-time career.
If you want to do something positive in the world, it should be something that reflects the generations to come, not just what you're doing.
Plus, the patchwork regulations governing using paddleboards on Michigan's lakes, and what Michigan's farmers could gain from a shift in U.S. relations with Cuba.
And the need in Cuba for food products that fit with the Cuban diet, things like dry beans, pork products, are what we do here in Michigan.
Those stories coming up on today's edition of Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. On today's show, we're going to talk about how strained political relationships between the United States and Cuba filters down into Michigan's agricultural economy.
The fact that we have a market that is so geographically close and where the demand aligns so well with what we produce right here in Michigan, it just doesn't make sense that Michigan agriculture is not able to engage in that market and conduct commerce with Cuba.
That's later in the show, but first, if you're following the Olympics and you want to be surprised by the results for today's action, now's the time to plug your ears. Today, American gymnast Suni Lee took gold in the all-around competition. It's an incredible feat. She's the world's first Hmong American to medal at the Olympics. Of course, her victory comes right after the sport's greatest of all time, Simone Biles, withdrew from competition due to headspace that left her feeling physically and emotionally vulnerable. So many questions raised about the mental well-being of athletes. And we think particularly for gymnasts in the shadow of the lingering Larry Nassar scandal, including survivor Simone Biles. Let's listen to her talking to NBC and about returning to the Olympics at 24 years old.
I feel like if there weren't a remaining survivor in the sport, they would have just brushed it to the side. But since I'm still here and I have quite a social media presence and platform, they have to do something.
With us to talk more about the stakes is Marissa Kwiatkowski. She's an investigative reporter for USA Today. You will well remember her work at the Indy Star. She's been reporting on Larry Nassar's abuse since the early days. Marissa, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
So you've spent the past couple of years covering USA Gymnastics and the abuse scandal. With that kind of background, what's been on your mind as you've been watching the games?
Really, what's been on my mind from a reporting perspective is how many questions are still left unanswered 5 years after we published the first piece in our investigation. There's still so much that we don't know. And there's still, for the survivors, so much that has not been resolved about what they've been through.
This is the first Olympics since Larry Nassar was on trial and was convicted. How much do you think the fallout from this case impacted the mood of gymnastics at this year's games?
I think certainly you just heard from Simone sharing part of her thought process and what she was going through. So certainly it's been part of the conversation, along with, of course, the incredible athleticism of all of the women involved with the team. But certainly there have been more conversations about it this week in light of the team finals and the individual all around.
You know, we are approaching a time when there will be more athletes competing who were not at the elite levels when Larry Nassar was practicing and abusing athletes. But there's been so much said about what has happened in the U.S. Olympic gymnastic movement. Do you think the calls for change have been heeded, that, as Simone Biles is suggesting, that the stories have not been forgotten?
I think it's important to understand that our broader investigation was never just about Larry Nassar. And USA Gymnastics had had an executive policy of not reporting allegations of child sexual abuse to authorities. So it's always been bigger than Larry Nassar. And just because he is in prison does not mean that everything has been fixed and that everything has been solved. Certainly, USA Gymnastics has talked about some of the efforts that they've made to improve child safety. There are new people in place. But the survivors and the advocates continue to say that more needs to be done to ensure the safety of kids in the sport, because at the end of the day, they said that's really what matters here.
Mm-hmm. Do you see differences in the coaching today, differences that might be evident to those watching elite level gymnastics?
I haven't watched closely enough to be able to respond to that adequately. What I can say is that certainly the conversation around coaching has changed beyond, again, just the Larry Nassar dynamic, but there has been a lot of conversation about what appropriate coaching should look like and what the expectation for someone working with an athlete should be.
One of the things that really struck me about what we learned, because of your reporting and those of others, was the degree to which, you know, what athletes were going through psychologically. Certainly the fact of the abuse, but also the fact that they were often, you know, competing with injuries where, you know, certainly somebody should have thought twice about sending them out in that condition. Do you get any sense, like, as you've been looking at things from the oversight level, that we're coming to a different understanding of what is asked of elite level athletes?
I do think that conversation is starting to change. I can't speak specifically to any instances, but that conversation is happening not only in the United States with USA Gymnastics, but it's also happening with other programs throughout the world. We've heard about these reckonings happening in the United Kingdom, in Australia, New Zealand, and other places where they've been revisiting these conversations about what is appropriate conduct and what does it really take to be able to get to that elite level.
Do you see some changes again in sort of the systemic things that we have learned about USA Gymnastics? Do you see that having an effect in other sports?
I haven't personally investigated some of these other sports, so it's difficult to say, but sexual abuse is not a gymnastics problem. It never was. It's not exclusive to gymnastics. It's not exclusive to the Catholic Church or Boy Scouts or any other organization. It's a pervasive community issue. And so certainly other organizations should be grappling with these questions. I know that there are some that are, but it's really something that hits on every aspect of society.
Some of the conversations this week that came to the foreground concerned Simone Biles' decision to step back from the games this year due to some things that were going on with her mental flexibility, you might say. I wonder if you think that an athlete taking themselves out of the games like that, if that could have happened prior to now.
Well, certainly it has happened in other sports. And so it's definitely possible. I think that the conversation is continuing to evolve. So you do see a number of athletes prioritizing their health as they're working on their craft or on their sport.
Do you see it as a big departure from the way USA Gymnastics used to do things? I mean, Carrie Strug certainly comes to mind, somebody who competed with an injury in which she should not have been out there.
That's a difficult question to answer because it's not really a USA Gymnastics decision. It was Simone Biles' decision, from what I understand of what happened here. So it wasn't really a system decision that was happening at this moment.
Just a few weeks ago, the U.S. Department of Justice's Office of the Inspector General released an investigation into how law enforcement, specifically the FBI, mishandled complaints against Larry Nassar. And then this week, we got news that Larry Nassar has been paying less than $10 a month toward the court-ordered restitution fund for survivors, even as he had thousands of dollars in his federal prison account. What kind of a month would you say this has been for the survivors and for their advocates?
It's just a continued call from survivors. Simone Biles has been raising her voice on this. Rachel Denhollander has been raising her voice on this. Many others have as well. The continued call for accountability and the need for accountability in order to move forward. And what you've seen and what you've described in both of those instances, the survivors feel like they're not seeing accountability by some of these actions.
Mm-hmm. And can you maybe share a little bit more with us about the questions that are still on your mind and whether, you know, whether that has anything to do with these revelations?
I think there are certainly more questions with the FBI's handling of it and the decision-making that happened. There were at least four FBI offices that received allegations against Larry Nassar prior to our report revealing allegations against him. And there's still questions about which specific individuals. Obviously, W.J. Abbott was named in the OIG report, but there are others that were not named. And so understanding better exactly what they did, how they did it, is a piece of understanding exactly what happened. And also what the survivors say is ensuring that it doesn't happen again.
Do you worry that people watching the games now think, well, this is all in the past?
As a journalist, I've heard from people even 2 or 3 years ago saying, it's over, right? Larry Nassar has been charged, or Larry Nassar is in prison. And that, from their perspective, meant that the problem was solved. But as I mentioned earlier, our investigation was never just about one man and his actions. It was about broader policies that were enabling people who may have bad intentions to be around underage athletes.
Well, I know I surely look on these things a little differently whenever I see an athlete giving 100% and more than 100%, partly because of what I know with your reporting. Marissa Kwiatkowski is a reporter for USA Today on the investigations team, formerly of the Indy Star. Marissa, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Tomorrow on the show, we're going to be speaking with Rachel Den Hollander. She was the first survivor of Larry Nassar's abuse to go public with her story. She's had a lot to say about this year's Olympics, Simone Biles, and about mental health. Please do join us for that conversation. Coming up, you might have seen or partaken in paddleboarding on one of Michigan's many beautiful lakes this summer. But you might not know the rules around what is legal with paddleboarding. It's a subject for some debate.
Technically, we don't have a specific rule that applies to paddleboards.
We'll talk about the confusion around floating on the water with a paddle next. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. In 2012, Jason Thielen was making a custom paddleboard for his then 9-year-old daughter. It earned them a lot of oohs and ahs when they took it out on the water, and eventually Jason found himself making a paddleboard for someone else. And then another, until his passion project became his full-time job. Jason specializes in hollow core wooden boards with contrasting colors of native Michigan woods married together in gorgeous geometric designs. Jason Thielen is the founder of Little Bay Boards, a custom paddleboard shop in Petoskey. Welcome, Jason.
Thanks for having me.
Can you give folks a sense? I want to ask you about the boards themselves, but what is the size of the Little Bay operation today compared with the early years?
Well, we're still growing, but you know, I started in a little lean-to that was probably about 8 foot wide and 16 feet long. And then I've grown systematically to a bigger garage, to a smaller shop. And then we just moved into a large facility. It's about 10,800 square feet. Purchased it right before COVID and then kind of took like a slow track of developing it. And we moved in probably in January of this year and started producing boards in March. So we're still pretty freshly new in the new building.
I almost feel like when I say custom stand-up paddleboard, like people aren't even going to understand until they go over to like your Instagram feed or something, because I think most of us have experience with, you know, the big fiberglass or plastic models that you can get at Dick's Sporting Goods or resale shops. But your boards are gorgeous. They're made of different kinds of native woods and I believe recovered woods too, right?
Yeah, we're definitely a unique product in the board industry, being hollow wooden, which isn't uncommon in surfboards, and it's kind of how surfboards started way back in the day, but they ended up being too bulky and heavy, and it took quite a while until engineering was achieved by my mentor, Paul Jensen, and when he figured that all out, surfboards came back into reality of being hollow wooden and very performance. And the SUPs are kind of just more of a, you know, mainstay of Michigan. We don't really have the surfing waters that, you know, you do out in the oceans. So I just developed an idea of how to make SUPs here out of natural resources. So I've been a hippie my whole life. My parents were hippies. Always cared about the environment. And if you want to do something positive in the world, it should be something that reflects the generations to come, not just what you're doing.
You have experience in carpentry, but can you tell us a little bit about the woodwork disciplines that led you to the designs that people see today?
Yeah. I had a long background in carpentry of, you know, 20 years working for my father-in-law, learning from knowing nothing all the way up to, you know, leading crews for him. He was a green, sustainable home builder too, long before it was a cool thing. Actually won some awards and stuff like that nationwide and whatnot. So I've always been instilled to, you know, pay attention to what you do environmentally wise. And when I got into the wood boards, it was only because I couldn't afford to buy a decent fiberglass board, raising a family and my wife stays at home and, you know, single income. And I was just Googling around and found that, you know, you could build wooden surfboards, and I figured you should be able to build a wooden SUP when it's not too much different. So it took a lot of studying and educating myself and going through things like that until I was able to build the first board, which is only just a glorified 8-foot longboard for my daughter, because she was only 9, weighed like 100 pounds.
Yeah. What was some of the early experimentation like as you were figuring out the design?
Oh, man, that's a good question. You know, being one of the first people to actually do it, there was a lot of experimentation. Also, you know, by invention of design is because you can't afford the tools that you need to actually do it right. So you have to reinvent how to do it with the things that you have, which was actually a blessing for me. I was very lucky to have so much wood knowledge and tool knowledge and the ability to make things work the way that I could afford them, and actually ended up making better products. And having Paul as my mentor to guide me through some of those things, you know, changed the game for me. My boards are known for their looks. Obviously, you know, if anybody gets a chance to look at the website, it's mind-blowing, some of the designs. I'm not trying to brag about myself. They're just really cool boards. You know, I have really good board builders, and we do some really, really, really cool things. But the designs of them are unique. The way that they float is unique. They're really well-performing boards, besides the fact that they're art to look at.
Yeah. For the first couple of years, there you were juggling the full-time work in carpentry with Little Bay's business. What was the transition like? How did you do this?
It was awful. No joke.
Oh, wow.
Well, it's just, you know, to be an entrepreneur and have to supply for a family and stuff like that, there's a lot of risks in starting your own business. You know, there's a lot of unforeseens and unknowns, and I'm not a business savvy person in any way whatsoever. You know, I'm a high school dropout and just know how to work really hard. The first couple of years, it was, you know, it was fun just to build a board on the side and get some Christmas money and, you know, a little vacation money and stuff like that. And I was working 60 hours a week or whatever. And then as the boards became more popular and people started noticing them, I started to get more orders, and I was trying to satisfy those, probably being a little money greedy, I guess, because it was all extra money. I was already working 50 hours normally. And then, you know, I was trying to fill in at night. And there was a transfer year of about like 9 months where I was pretty dedicated to about 100 hours a week, and still trying to take the weekends off to be with my family. So that meant that I went to work at 4 o'clock in the morning and didn't get home till 11 o'clock at night.
Oh, man.
Then I'd be exhausted on the weekends and pretty much pointless for my, you know, to be around my family. You know, it was a struggle. I have a very strong-minded, very willful wife that understood what I was trying to do and was there to help me, but it wasn't easy. I mean, there's nothing easy about doing that. You know, being dedicated that hard to working that many hours, it affects everything else around you. You know, the company was thriving while, you know, my health and life was deteriorating. There's a huge pivotal point in all of that. I came home one night, probably like 11:30 or something, you know, fifth day in a row, looking forward to having Saturday on the beach with the kids. And my wife was sitting at the table with two beers. And I was like, oh, you know, this is going to be the conversation. Here it is. She's sick of everything that I've been doing to her, you know. And she sat me down and she had this little doll thing, and it was like this little paper mache doll with this raggedy head of yarn, and I asked what it was, and it was Shawnee, my now oldest daughter. She's the one I first built the board for. It was how she'd say goodnight to me at night because I was never home, and it was, you know, her little daddy doll. that was the moment of, you know, I got to stop what I'm doing, or I need to commit 100% to what I'm doing for everything, you know, for my family, my children, being a father, being a husband, and everything else. And so I decided to make the jump from my full-time career job that I had that was, you know, excellent and, you know, paved my way to adulthood. And as my father-in-law, if I could quit for a while and try to chase the board life just to see if I could actually make it work.
Man, I mean, people talk about that startup life and what small businesses are like, but moments like that. Yeah, nobody prepares you for that, I think.
No, you know, some people will bring it up, you know, and I try to watch or listen to podcasts about people who start their business, and the family always seems to be the one that's overlooked, you know, and nobody ever remembers that you have a whole nother life that you're supposed to dedicate hours to, you know?
Yeah.
And when you're chasing a dream, it's easy to forget that really quickly and, you know, get wrapped up in how much work and how hard it is to make something actually happen.
So did it get easier once you just committed to the boards?
Yeah, for the first little while it did. I was in my parents' garage at the time because my dad had a little wood shop that I grew up in. I could be in there after I quit my full-time job. I could build 3 boards a month and be pretty comfortable, you know, but that was, you know, before a legit business was actually created. You know, I was having a hard time paying my taxes and all the legalities that go into stuff like that. But I was building really cool boards and, you know, just enjoying what I was doing and, you know, trying harder to build even cooler boards to get more recognition and get the word out there more often and whatnot. And it was pretty comfortable. And then, you know, I started getting orders for enough boards that people weren't willing to wait like 4 or 5 months, and I was losing sales. And I was getting kind of concerned about that. I didn't want to lose sales. I needed sales, you know, pay for everything. Then I moved into a little bit larger facility. It was about 2,500 square feet. And I was able to build 5 boards a month there. And that was pretty good. But then making that commitment, there's always in Michigan, there's slow season. And this is before, you know, I was kind of, you know, known around the United States or anything, before Little Bay Boards was really that popular. It was just mostly locals. Every once in a while, I have an out-of-state person. So there were struggles there. You know, you'd have times where you just didn't get any orders and there's just no money coming in. And, you know, luckily I was still a carpenter and I could float back and go do like a flooring job or a roofing job for my father-in-law to make ends meet. And then just try to, you know, figure out the rhyme and reason of why I wasn't getting orders or why I wasn't getting recognized, or, you know, Facebook posts weren't getting noticed, or, you know, I was doing all my own marketing and my own branding and all that other silly stuff. Mm. So, yeah, it wasn't giant rainbows and butterflies until, you know, this last year. And I'm blessed to do what I do. And the boards are amazing. And I'm thankful every day that I wake up to go to work, build what I build. But, you know, building business is crazy, especially with COVID. And, you know, we got all new employees now and, you know, bigger building that's half done. And, you know, there's things, but still blessed to do it. It's just, it's hard to explain it to people when they say, wow, really good for you. And it's like, well, bigger places, bigger problems at times, but you
right,
know, still
right.
Very, very, very blessed.
Jason, I read that you are the great, great, great grandson of Chief Petoskey.
Yes.
Are there ways that you think your family background has shaped maybe your work or just the person that you are today?
Yeah. You know, everybody's got their stories of their life. Anything that's ever happened to me is either something that I wanted to replicate or something that I wanted to make sure I never did ever again, or, you know, learn from that way. You know, my father was David Petoskey. He died when I was very, very, very young. In a tragic party situation. So that molded me to a certain man that I was in my teenage years and my 20 years, which wasn't a good person. But then I met my wife, who taught me how to be a good person. And my stepfather, who's raised me since I was like 3 and a half or something like that, is a good man. You know, he taught me to be a man. He was not soft in any way. And that made me a very diligent worker and a very diligent father, you know, obviously with shortcomings, nobody's ever perfect. But and my mom's always been a hard worker, and chasing a dream has always been not one of their things that they ever thought to do. And it was really helpful when I did talk to them about wanting to chase my dream and them telling me to, you know, stay where I was at, and don't push the buttons, and, you know, you can't do this for a living, you know. And I heard that from multiple people when I first started it. And every time I heard a no, it made me drive harder just to prove people wrong.
Well, given how much change has just happened in the past couple of years, if 2012 Jason could see Little Bay Boards now, what do you think the biggest surprise would be for him?
That the 10-year goal that I wrote down was actually achievable. To remind myself that feeling that the hardest thing was to quit my day job and do what I was doing was probably one of the easiest steps in building a company and building a business and, you know, employing people and stuff like that. And just to remind myself that it takes a lot of guts every day that you show up to work to invent something that hasn't really been what it, you know, it is. It's one of our hardest things as a company is to recognize we don't have anybody that we can ask how they did this because we're the first company to do it this way.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing the story of you and the partnerships that you forged along the way, Jason. It's just the boards are beautiful and we really appreciate everything you bring into the world.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Jason Thielen is the founder of Little Bay Boards in Petoskey. As the paddleboard boom continues across Michigan, questions keep on popping up like, are there rules for paddleboards? Do you consider these things vessels or boats or rafts or something more like a personal flotation device? Joining us now to give the answers is Corporal Ivan Perez. He's a conservation officer with Michigan's Department of Natural Resources and has interaction with a lot of these rules. Corporal Perez, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
It's impossible not to notice the popularity of paddleboards. There's so many more people out on water doing this than there were 10 or 15 years ago. Are there rules or specific regulations that pertain to them?
To paddleboards, no. Obviously, the industry has taken off over the last few years and has become, you know, very popular. Under Michigan law, if you were to look at the definition of a vessel, this would meet the definition of a vessel. You know, our laws say vessels must be equipped with the personal flotation device, a PFD, for each person on board. We create rules under Part 801, which is our marine safety part of the Natural Resources Environmental Protection Act. And these rules speak to what type of safety equipment each type of vessel needs to have. Right now, our rules only indicate for non-motorized vessels to include canoes and kayaks. There's no verbiage yet that includes paddle boards or vessels of that type. So technically, we don't have a specific rule that applies to paddle boards.
I don't want to detail this to death, but
right.
What is the definition of a vessel? I mean, I think of a paddleboard. It certainly looks and functions a lot like a kayak, but at the same time, they're not really suitable for longer trips, and it seems like they do provide some personal flotation if you're clinging to one. So what is the definition of a vessel in Michigan?
Under Michigan law, which is at Part 801, it says that a vessel means every description of watercraft used or capable of being used as a means of transportation on the water. So that kind of covers just about everything, if you think about it.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, there are exclusions to things like a man-made raft or something to that effect. There's some exclusionary things that you'll find. Of course, the whole spirit of the law regarding personal flotation devices is to prevent unnecessary drownings, obviously. So whenever we get these newer devices that come in, we tend to try to look at it as a whole to how it's going to be used, the popularity, you know, a blow up raft or a tube that you would use to float a river, you know, would fit the definition of a vessel, but it's more of a toy than it is a vessel. And so there's these areas that where we slip in and out of where does this definition fit and do we have rules that will protect persons who are utilizing them. Right now, the U.S. Coast Guard on waters where we share jurisdiction with them, so that would be like the U.S. Great Lakes and connecting waters, They require a paddleboarder to have a personal flotation device on. Their definition says if they're operating, you know, or using this paddleboard outside of a swim area or outside of a surf zone, then you would have to wear one.
Yeah.
Well, Michigan law says that you can't operate a vessel in a swim area, so that's out. And the Great Lakes don't have a tidal influence, so we don't really have a surf zone that you would find on larger oceans.
Right.
We do tend to try to match federal requirements for all things navigation. So I could see in the future possibly that you may see laws or rules come into place to remedy these gray areas.
So if we're out on inland lakes this summer, and maybe county sheriff's departments are out on patrol, some people have received tickets for not having life preservers on board, so to speak, while they're using a paddleboard. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, how this patchwork is playing out?
Right. Well, every situation is different. If anybody's receiving a ticket, obviously there's two sides of the coin there. But as of right now, we don't have a law that states, or a rule, I should say, that states that paddleboarders have to have a life preserver on them or with them. But it is highly recommended.
Well, we want to thank you so much for helping us interpret this a bit. Corporal Ivan Perez of Michigan's Department of Natural Resources, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
One of the hot topics in U.S. policy right now is the Biden administration's stance on Cuba. This is an issue that Michigan farmers have been following for a long time. After the break, we'll hear about the issues involved and the balance of ag policy and human rights policies that are in play. We'll be right back. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. It's hard to have a foreign policy discussion in Washington without Cuba coming up, so close to the United States mainland, so important to Florida's 29 electoral votes. Cuba represents a lot of complicated things here in the States. That country is also in the grip of a terrible crisis right now related to the pandemic and an economic crisis related to U.S. sanctions that now stretch over 50 years. Cuba is also, maybe you didn't know this, important to Michigan. With us today are Chuck Lipstrew, president of the Michigan Agribusiness Association, and Felix Sharp Caballero. He lives in mid-Michigan. He's a Cuban-American and has been active in groups like the National Network on Cuba and El Pan, advocating for change in U.S. policy and for outreach to the Cuban people. Chuck, Felix, welcome to Stateside.
Good to be with you.
Thank you.
Chuck, what do we mean when we're talking about trade with Cuba? What sort of products are important?
Michigan has the second most diverse agricultural economy in America, right behind California. And a big reason why is we produce all of the commodity crops you would think of, corn, soybeans, things of that nature. We also produce specialty crops, fruits and vegetables. Up along the west side of Michigan, we're also a leading livestock production state. Laying hens, poultry, turkeys, pork, all come from Michigan. And those products are almost all exported around the world right now. Michigan hit $3 billion in agricultural exports last year. And actually, April, even during the COVID-19 pandemic, we increased agricultural exports from Michigan. Unfortunately, right now, we're not able to export to Cuba, which is a market of 9 million people just 90 miles off the coast of Florida. And the need in Cuba for food products that fit with the Cuban diet, things like dry beans, pork products, are what we do here in Michigan. So it's a real untapped market. And that's why we have pushed for many years. Cuba is not a new issue for us. We've pushed for many years to roll back the embargo on Cuba, which has not resulted in substantive change or achieved the U.S. government's objectives. It's been in place for more than 60 years, and it has not led to any sort of change. And so our message to multiple administrations over the years has been, we need to find ways to engage and enact two-way trade with the Cuban people. And that's an opportunity for Michigan, but it's also an opportunity to build a stronger bond between the U.S. and Cuba, which is very important.
Chuck, how do you explain the, I mean, is this a matter of the fact that Cuba is so close to the United States and so geographically close to Michigan and that it's crazy not to be doing business there? Like, why Cuba in particular?
Well, look, right now we export Michigan agricultural products all over the globe. So thinking about just one product we produce here in Michigan that we're actually really well known for, which is dry beans. We produce a wide range of dry bean varieties in Michigan, in the Saginaw Valley and the Thumb of Michigan primarily, but also all over the state. And one of the top varieties of bean that we produce is black beans, which are in demand in Cuba, but we also send Michigan-grown beans right now all over the world, to Europe, to Asia, to Africa, to South America. And so when you think about it in that context, April, the fact that we have a market that is so geographically close and where the demand aligns so well with what we produce right here in Michigan, it just doesn't make sense that that Michigan agriculture is not able to engage in that market and conduct commerce with Cuba.
Gotcha. Felix, you're a mid-Michigan resident and Cuban-American, and you have family in Cuba. Can I just start by asking how your family's doing?
My family is struggling. All families in Cuba are struggling right now as a result of the 243 policy actions that former President Donald Trump implemented, including the inability for us to send money to them. So it's a hard time in Cuba right now.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of crazy. Like, you can send a money order just about anywhere in the world, in the Western world, and not to Cuba. What has it been like watching the protests that happened over the past couple of weeks? This very rare sight that hasn't really happened much in most people's living memory, of Cubans in the streets protesting the government and what's going on right now during the pandemic and the crackdowns that followed that.
It's been difficult to watch because it's never happened in Cuba. And the reason that it did happen is because it was orchestrated out of South Florida by an agency that is funded by USAID, intended to destabilize the Cuban government. They used the hunger and despair that exists as a result of a year and a half in lockdown to encourage people to take to the streets, citing that there were ships outside of a port in Cuba ready to deliver food, but the Cuban government had rejected that food. It was all a lie under SOS Cuba. And so the other thing that was disturbing to see is how people took to the streets, because we knew that Cuba had been able to control the spread in the virus. But after that event, the cases in Cuba tripled, literally 3 or 4 days later. And so Cuba is now in an emergency medical crisis state, as well as a food security crisis state.
Yeah. Chuck, if we can turn this back to your side of this, what have leaders in Cuba said about doing business with farmers in America and farmers in Michigan? I mean, in the larger context of this policy debate that's going on, I mean, are we on their radar?
Yes, absolutely. And the reason why is, again, we produce a wide variety of crops and commodities that are in demand and needed in Cuba. And the thing that sets Cuba apart is not a lack of desire on the part of Cuba to do business with the United States. It's an inability to conduct commerce due to U.S. government policy that's been in place for some time, April. And specifically for agriculture, and there are some agricultural exports that move to Cuba. They are very limited in nature and highly restricted. The main issue that we have right now is an inability to provide credit to Cuba. So U.S. exporters can't provide credit, which is a very common, you know, export procedure due to trade restrictions that are in place that are very specific to Cuba and one part of the larger embargo that remains in place. So one very straightforward policy action that could be taken among many would be to allow for credit to be offered to Cuba to pay for U.S. exports, because it's a cash poor economy. So credit's a very important piece of it. But the other piece of it is, and Felix alluded to this, you know, we've really been on a roller coaster ride here during the last, especially the last decade or so, where you had the Obama administration took steps to move toward a more normalized relationship with Cuba. If we remember, it was during that administration that a Cuban embassy was reopened in Washington, D.C., and likewise, a U.S. embassy was established in Havana. We also need congressional action to fully normalize relations with Cuba. The Trump administration, as Felix mentioned, took some steps then to roll back the Obama administration actions, not all of them, but many of them. And now we're in a situation where we have a new administration in Washington. The Biden administration has been in place now for, you know, 6 months and 9 days. And, you know, there's a big question about what the Biden administration will do with regard to Cuba. Our perspective is the administration would be well served to do all it can to normalize relations with Cuba. And enable agriculture to fill that demand for food, especially places like Michigan, California, that grow staples of the Cuban diet.
If you're just joining us, my guests today are Chuck Lipstrew, president of the Michigan Agribusiness Association, and Felix Sharp Caballero. He lives in mid-Michigan. He's Cuban-American and active with El PAN and other organizations that have a voice in U.S.-Cuban relations. Felix, I wanted to ask you what it's like to watch a president like Joe Biden, a Democrat, continuing policies that Republicans have been instrumental putting into place, the kind of sanctions that we've seen. What do you make of that?
Well, it's interesting that you would ask that. I've heard it said that Donald Trump is still in the White House as it relates to Cuba. Every American president has taken some measure of working and dialoguing with Cuba. President Biden has taken a different approach. I believe it is related to the fact that he's trying to first get his domestic policy in order. As you know, the infrastructure legislation just began to gain ground yesterday.
Right.
And there's some other things that he's interested in getting done. The problem is the Democrats like Bob Menendez, who are stalling the relationship with Cuba moving forward. He needs their vote, and that is what is affecting his ability to move forward on Cuba. But the longer he waits, the worse things will get.
I think the difficulty is expressing extreme displeasure with the leadership over the crackdowns on dissent that have happened without causing more suffering among the Cuban people. I think that's what reps like Bob Menendez and Rashida Tlaib would say if they were here. How do you think about threading that needle?
Well, the reality is that there was one life lost during the insurrection, because that's what it was to some degree. And you did not see pepper spray being used. You did not see rubber bullets being used. And I believe in the main, the Cuban government did the best it could do to quell that uprising that it had never seen. If you compare what occurred in Cuba to what occurred here in the United States last year with Black Lives Matters, the disparity tends to side with the Cuban government's response rather than American law enforcement's response. So, yes, we don't like to see repression, and Cuba has a long way to go with regard to allowing free speech. That is for certain. But the reaction from law enforcement in Cuba was much less repressive than what we've seen here in the United States lately.
Chuck, several.
April?
Oh, yes, Chuck, go ahead.
Sorry, let me weigh in on this too, because I think this is a really important point with regard to U.S. foreign policy. You know, we export and have two-way trade agreements and or trade interaction, I should say, with a wide range of governments that we don't agree with on much of anything. And the leading example of that is the government of China, which is a leading export destination for U.S. agriculture products. And obviously, we import a tremendous amount of goods from China. I don't think anybody in the White House or in many parts of our government would fully endorse all of the actions of the government of China, but we understand that there's a need to have open commerce and trade and interaction and dialogue with China. That's just one example of many. That's what sets Cuba apart. It's the only situation, or it's a unique situation, because we have a 63-year-old embargo that at the time we thought would result in change in terms of the government in place in Cuba. And obviously that hasn't happened after, you know, more than 62 years of this policy. And so that's why we've said this for years, you know, having that two-way trade relationship and a dialogue with Cuba doesn't mean we endorse everything that the government of Cuba does or is. It means that we're willing to engage. And that's a more realistic pathway to changing Cuba than the embargo, obviously, because we've been trying the embargo for the last 62 years and it hasn't achieved our objectives.
Sure. Chuck, several members of the Michigan legislature flew to Cuba last February, right before the pandemic shutdown. That seems like it was about a decade ago now. And I want to say that Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirkey was supposed to go on the trip, but he canceled at the last minute. Can you tell us a little bit about the goal and what happened?
Sure. So that visit included, as you mentioned, several members of the Michigan legislature. It included Agriculture Director Gary McDowell and a delegation from our association, from the Michigan Agribusiness Association, along with a variety of companies based right here in Michigan that produce products or ingredients that could be exported to Cuba if policy were changed. And that visit was one of a few we've made over the course of several years that was really designed to make sure that we build bonds and dialogue with those who are responsible for importing food products in Cuba and have that two-way dialogue to be sure that when the time comes, and I do think it will come when we have an opportunity to export agricultural products from Michigan, grown right here in Michigan, to Cuba, that we already are in their Rolodex, so to speak, that we have those relationships. Because I do think we're going to come to a time where Michigan agriculture can participate in that market, where products grown right here in Michigan can be exported to Cuba. But once that time comes, it's going to be very important to know who to reach out to and to have those established relationships. So that's Ag Trade 101. Make sure you're communicating and make sure you're talking. So that was one very important goal. And the second was to be sure that we heard from Cuban representatives what would be useful in a two-way trade partnership or a two-way trade relationship, because there's a variety of things happening in Cuba that could be useful for us here in Michigan. Specifically, Cuba, because virtually all the cropland or potentially all the cropland in Cuba is organic production, they certainly have a lot of expertise in that area. It's a growing market here in the United States. And there's also opportunity for interaction with regard to education and agricultural research. You know, Michigan is home to the premier land-grant university in America, the first one and the best one at Michigan State University. And so there's a huge amount of knowledge and expertise that we can also provide, I believe, to Cuba if we're able to participate more fully in a two-way relationship. So think about last year's visit as one part of a long-term effort to make sure we have a strong partnership in place between Michigan and Cuba, because the time is going to come at some point when we are able to work more closely together.
If I can add to that, April, we are currently working with the Michigan Legislative Black Caucus and Senator Marshall Bullock and Senator Erica Geis planning for a November trip to Cuba with the caucus. And so the interest from Michigan to Cuba and from Cuba to Michigan is significant, and it continues.
Felix, when you think about what has been most effective in terms of U.S. policy and the Cuban government in more recent history, I mean, we're looking at changing situations in Cuba. I don't want to overstate that too much, but what do you think yields the best results at this stage?
The best results are yielded by bilateral relations and negotiations and discussions. Evidence that what transpired in Cuba on July 11th was able to occur because Cubans now have access to the internet. Prior to 2014, when Barack Obama re-engaged with Cuba, Cubans were in the dark ages. When you visited there, they weren't connected to the world and the internet. But one of the things that Barack Obama required of the Cuban government was that Cubans have access to the internet. And today, Cuba has gone through dramatic changes from creating business opportunities for its citizens to restructuring its financial economy, eliminating the three monetary systems that they have. And they're moving forward as a result of some of those negotiations and discussions. And that really is where the answer lies to end this 60-year blockade of the Cuban people, which is driven by the Confederate Cubans in Miami, who lost the Civil War in Cuba, landed in Miami, and have since then been driving U.S. policy towards Miami. Americans, by and large, polls revealed 65% support normalizing relations with Cuba.
We'd like to thank our guest today, Felix Sharp Caballero, who lives in mid-Michigan, active with El PAN and other advocacy groups. Also, Chuck Lipstrew, president of the Michigan Agribusiness Association. Felix, Chuck, it's a pleasure.
Thanks very much, April. Appreciate the opportunity to be here with you.
Good day. Thank you.
Just a final note, we did reach out to Senator Debbie Stabenow, chair of the Senate Committee on Agriculture, Nutrition, and Forestry, who's obviously been deeply involved in this topic. We did not hear back, but look forward to discussing it with her as soon as possible. And that's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Thanks for being with us. We'll see you tomorrow.